how liberty dies. With thunderous applause.
Welcome to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm your host, Scott, with Uncle Ian, and today we have for you Fidel Castro versus Francois Papa Doc Duvalier. Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause is a history podcast obsessed with history's biggest dictators. We have created a knockout competition to determine the single most significant dictator of all time. Each episode features a matchup of two dictators where we discuss the life and times of each leader. The loser of each battle is eliminated from the tournament. The winner remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. Quick spoiler alert for those who have not listened to the previous episodes. I'm just going to do a quick recap of the previous episodes thus far. Julius Caesar has defeated Benito Mussolini. Ivan the Terrible lost to Vladimir Lenin. And Genghis Khan narrowly defeated Deng Xiaoping.
Is that our closest result so that far, is Scott?
I think that's
our closest. Spoiler alert.
Last week, Saddam Hussein defeated Persian dictator Xerxes. Let's get to Fidel Castro and Papa Doc Duvalier. Going to Cuba first, let's talk about Fidel. Fidel Castro was the Cuban dictator who ruled from 1959 until 2008. So he had a very long innings. Fidel Castro was born on the 13th of August, 1926, on his father's farm. His mother was actually his father's servant. The Cuba Castro was born into is an independent nation. It's a democracy, famous for its gambling and prostitution tourism. In 1933, Sergeant Batista overthrew the government, and in 1952, he turned his rule into a military dictatorship. Military rule of Batista is very repressive, very strict. This is the Cuba that Fidel Castro grows up in. Fidel Castro, like two of our previous dictators, was expelled from school for bad behavior. We've had Mussolini and Saddam Hussein already expelled from school. We should be keeping an eye on these kids. So he was sent to Havana for school instead. And he then went on to university. And as we've already discovered, again, university campuses are radicalization hotspots. And Castro quickly became a violent activist. Havana University was a largely separate jurisdiction, which offered students a great deal of freedom that they didn't have outside the university in Cuba. It was kind of a legal jurisdiction all to itself, which enabled them to have political discussions. In 1953, Castro attempts to overthrow the government by storming the Monchado army barracks to steal weapons. It was a massive failure. 60 of his men died. 3 cars broke down en route to the barracks. It didn't work out well. Castro was caught and put on trial, and he very cleverly used the trial to promote his politics. He made his famous speech, "History will absolve me," saying that even if he's found guilty, history will consider him on the right side of history. And that speech becomes a pamphlet, which is distributed throughout Cuba. He promises land, education, and food. Castro is sentenced to 15 years in prison, but he's released after 2 years because Batista, dictator of Cuba, believes it would improve his image and make him look lenient and merciful. But it was a massive mistake. Castro immediately begins preparing for his next revolution. He goes to Mexico and recruits Argentinian doctor named Che Guevara, who you may have seen on many t-shirts. The two of them, with their little army, invades Cuba from Mexico, and his soldiers are blown to bits by Batista's army. Both Fidel and Che survive, and they begin recruiting again. He charms the poor people who live in the countryside. He manages to get a lot of people to his cause. He's promoting vague center-left ideas, and he's promising elections and an end to the corruption of the Batista regime. Batista claims that Fidel Castro is dead, which takes a lot of the energy out of his campaign. So Castro calls up the New York Times and gets their most prestigious author over to cover a story about him. Herbert Matthews writes this adoring piece about Fidel Castro, and Fidel famously tricks him. I just think this is the best. Fidel Castro tricks him into thinking he's got thousands of troops. So he gets the same 20 soldiers to march past the reporter, and each time they change their clothes slightly, and Matthews believes that he's got thousands of soldiers. It's just so good. It's like something out of a cartoon. He's very good at his propaganda, and he does amass a sizable army, and he starts a guerrilla warfare campaign against the Batista regime. He doesn't really win the war. It's more that the Batista regime just collapses under their own inefficiency and lack of belief. But in 1958, Batista lost control as Cubans revolted against him. Castro arrives in Havana and gives his maiden speech and declaring himself the leader of Cuba. And he claims to be a Democrat and not a communist. And during this speech, they release doves into the air, and one of which lands on his shoulder. And the dove in Cuba is this symbol of the gods, and it's seen as Castro's divine right to rule. Castro gives his speech with this dove sitting on his shoulder the entire time. Castro then goes about killing Batista's followers and giving them show trials, which doesn't set a very good start for the Castro regime. Castro is now president of Cuba. Let's talk about some of the good things he was able to achieve. Like some of our previous dictators, he embarked on a literacy program, lifting literacy rate to above 95%, which is pretty good. The only downside, of course, is that in Cuba, you can only read communist-approved material. The life expectancy in Cuba also rose to 78 years, which is comparable to most Western countries. The other thing that we should mention is that Castro sent troops to fight in the Angolan Civil War. Now, this is significant because the Angolan communists eventually were to fight against the South African apartheid regime. And when Nelson Mandela was released from prison and became president of South Africa, he stated that the Cuban defeat of the South African apartheid army contributed to the weakening of the regime. I like Mandela and I dislike apartheid, so I'm going to give Castro a bit of credit for this. The only downside is that Angola today is an unfree country with one of the lowest life expectancies in the world. So it didn't really do the Angolans any good, but it was a significant moment for the Castro government. Let's talk about the bad things, and there's a lot. Upon getting into power, he seized and redistributed land. He even took his mother's property and redistributed that. He seized private businesses. Under his rule, 1/6 of the population fled the country. 1/6, that's too many. They fled due to the economic deprivation. Now, Fidel in the beginning said he's not going to be a communist. He started to very quickly become a communist. So the 1/6 of the country fled due to the economic deprivation, due to the communist policies, and as well as the American embargo, because once he started to seize American-owned businesses and exhibit communist traits, the Americans weren't having a bar of that, and they decided to impose an embargo wherein Cuban goods cannot be sold to America. That obviously had a terrible impact on the economic situation in Cuba. During that time, Cuba became the third poorest country in the Caribbean. They were supported financially by the Soviet Union. Castro was very clever. As soon as the Americans started to embargo him, he publicly calls himself a communist. Here's a famous quote of Fidel Castro. He says, "I am a Marxist-Leninist, and I will be until the last days of my life." When the Soviet Union collapsed, that led to further economic problems for Cuba. So Castro, very cleverly, used his charm and his worldwide fame to elicit favors. So Hugo Chavez, the left-wing president of Venezuela, gives Cuba cheap oil, and that helps Cuba to keep them afloat. Cubans today earn between $17 and $30 US per month, which is less than a dollar per day. So they're not doing too well. The other bad thing that really annoys me about Castro is that American President Jimmy Carter...
Carter was president between 77 and 81.
Thank you, Uncle Ian. Jimmy Carter offers to normalize relations with Cuba. So that would start the process of ending the embargo. And Fidel Castro refuses this offer because he's worried that foreign money and foreign ideas would loosen his grip on the Cuban populace. And this is a guy who came to power promising food and land and prosperity and an end to corruption. And this guy's literally preventing money coming to the country to keep himself in power. The elections that he promised were never delivered. All news media is controlled by the government. Today, Cuba is ranked 168 out of 180 for press freedoms. Tens of thousands of political opponents were imprisoned. So with his brother, Raul, they were paid by Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar to smuggle cocaine to the United States. Fidel wanted the income, and he wanted to use the drugs to destabilize America. The 1980s, this wreaked havoc on inner city and black communities within America. Escobar's bodyguard revealed that the communication between Castro and Escobar occurred through Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He's the very, very famous author who won a Nobel Prize for literature. It's literally the three most famous Latin Americans of all time are colluding to sell drugs to the Americans. The Americans were onto him. So Fidel Castro ended the drug selling program and had all of the people involved in it arrested and executed. as well as one of the war heroes from the war with Angola, General Ronaldo Ochoa, which I'm pronouncing incorrectly, he's executed as a drug smuggler, despite the fact that he had no involvement. And Fidel Castro did this because the general's fame and popularity is something that he was afraid of. He was worried that he could lead a coup and replace him. And Fidel Castro wasn't having any of this, so he threw him under the bus and...
he became the scapegoat.
The other thing that Fidel Castro did was, on assuming power, he purged Cuba of homosexuality. Homosexuality was seen as hedonistic and therefore anti-communist. The gays were re-educated in camps or imprisoned in prison cells that were 1 meter high. Fidel Castro himself was not gay. It was reported in 2008 that he slept with 35,000 women. It's a lot. That's two a day. He would have guards who would walk around the beach looking for women they would send to Fidel. He even had sex with an American spy sent to kill him.
Straight out of James Bond, that one.
And it would have helped that he embezzled $500 million, making him one of the richest leaders in the world. Even though he publicly stated that he lived on the official Cuban state government income. His many luxury yachts say differently. The most impressive thing about Castro is his longevity. Despite a reported 600 assassination attempts by the CIA, he managed to be in power 49 years. The CIA tried to kill him in every way possible. Exploding cigars, poisoned pens, cyanide pill in his chocolate milk. It's a good way to go, though. He died having a chocolate milk. A gun hidden into a camera. Pumping LSD into the recording studio. The most recent one was in 2000, the year 2000, and where 90 kilograms of explosives was placed under the podium where he's going to speak. There was even an attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro's beard. The plan was to sprinkle thallium, a chemical which produces hair loss, and they thought they were going to get rid of Fidel Castro's famous beard. It must be a very important beard. I think Fidel Castro once said that he would shave his beard off when he fulfilled his promise of good government to the Cubans, and he never eventually shaved it off.
It speaks volume.
Uncle Ian, has your moustache ever had to survive an assassination attempt?
No, fortunately, if you discount a couple on the rugby field from my breakaway days.
All right, so there's two very important events that we need to talk about with Castro. First is the Bay of Pigs, 1961. So President Kennedy declares no American armed forces would ever invade Cuba. So what he sneakily does is he finds Cuban exiles, one of the many hundreds of thousands of people who flees Cuba to America. He organizes 1,500 of them. The CIA train them and arm them. And then they get a boat to Cuba to try to overthrow Fidel Castro. Very unsuccessful. I would say a complete disaster. They were bombed to oblivion by the Air Force. The local revolutionaries never turned up, and the Americans refused to rescue them. The survivors were trialed and later sent back to America for $52 million in food and medicine. And so the Bay of Pigs invasion was an absolute disaster. American intervention actually helped Fidel Castro immensely. The Cubans could have hated Castro for the poverty and the repression that his government created and imposed. But instead, American involvement united the Cubans behind Castro. Cuban nationalism triumphed over any concern about communism because the Cubans just wanted to be left alone. They saw America as an imperialist aggressor. Castro emerged from the scene as the great defender of Cuba. Che Guevara actually sent a letter to President Kennedy, and it said, "Thanks for the Bay of Pigs. Before the invasion, the revolution was weak. Now it's stronger than ever." Which is true, but gloating. Che Guevara, I'll just quickly mention, was killed by the CIA and Bolivian soldiers in 1967, and Castro turned him into a martyr of the leftist movement. So all the t-shirts and other imagery that you see, that was Fidel Castro's doing.
You mentioned Che Guevara, and I find him quite fascinating. Background in Argentina, became a doctor. He actually had Irish background, played rugby at a very high level. He was a fly half, loved revolutions. He was a bit of a globetrotter when it came to spreading the leftist message. So before getting caught, killed in Bolivia, he did a lot of time in Africa as well to try and help with the revolution in what became the Congo. But he was a big part of Castro's revolution, and in the early years of Castro's government, he was almost on an equal footing with Castro. And at one time or another, Che Guevara was involved in land reform. He helped manage the literacy program. although I take your point, I'm not sure of the value of having a literacy program if there's actually not that much you're allowed to read. He was National Bank president at one stage. He got a lot of credit for the repelling of the Bay of Pigs invasion because he'd been an army trainer. So he was very busy in the years up until 1965 when he left to go to Africa. And there's massive statues in Havana of Che Guevara commemorating his work in helping Castro come to power.
If anyone's interested in Che Guevara, I recommend you watch the excellent movie The Motorcycle Diaries, which covers his time in Argentina and South America. Alrighty. Moving on to the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is the thing that we will remember Fidel Castro for the next 100 years. This happens 1 year later after the Bay of Pigs. On October 14th, 1962, a US spy plane photographs Soviet Union missiles in Cuba. 60 kilometers from the American coast, there are nuclear missiles. This is a massive concern for everybody in America. Everybody in the Western Hemisphere, this is a massive concern. Kennedy's, he decides to create a naval quarantine or blockade to stop any more materials getting to Cuba. They call it a quarantine rather than a blockade because a blockade is an act of war, so they give it a different name, which seems to work. And Khrushchev is shocked. The Soviet leader is shocked. He thought Kennedy would just cop it. He really had a very low opinion of Kennedy. On October 23, Khrushchev refuses to remove the missiles. And Castro has been sidelined from all of the discussions because he's just a passenger. But Castro is a nutcase and he says to the Soviet ambassador, he wants to wipe the Americans off the face of the earth. He sends a message to Khrushchev telling him to launch a nuclear first strike against the US. I have a quote from the letter he sends to Khrushchev. That would be the moment to eliminate this danger forever in an act of the most legitimate self-defense. However harsh and terrible the solution, there would be no other. Khrushchev decides that Castro is a madman. When Khrushchev reads the letter, he says, "This is insane. Fidel wants us to drag us into the grave with him." Khrushchev writes a letter to Kennedy. He, like Castro and Kennedy, know nuclear war could begin at any moment. Neither wanted to strike first, but neither could afford to strike second. Because if you strike second, you're already dead. Khrushchev writes his letter to Kennedy. "Mr. President, we and you ought not to pull on the ends of the rope in which you have tied the knot of war, because the more the two of us pull, the tighter that knot will be tied." I like that. It's good imagery.
He's a wordsmith.
I know, he's quite good. I like Khrushchev.
His translator is a wordsmith anyway.
Maybe it was completely different. Khrushchev promises to remove the missiles from Cuba. If America promises not to invade Cuba and remove the missiles they have in Turkey, which is right up against the Soviet Union. The next day, on Saturday, October 27th, which is known as Black Saturday, an American plane is shot down over Cuba. And this is the closest the world's been to nuclear war. But Kennedy decides not to retaliate. He decides to assume that Khrushchev did not give the order, a subordinate who has taken an initiative that they should not have taken. So Kennedy agrees not to invade Cuba, and Khrushchev, after sleeping that night on the lounge in the Kremlin, publicly announces to remove the missiles from Cuba. Kennedy also agrees to remove the missiles from Turkey, and so together, Kennedy and Khrushchev avert nuclear annihilation, no thanks to Castro. They also decide to create a hotline between the two countries that they can communicate with each other, because Khrushchev was so worried that he just announces the removal publicly because he thinks, oh, there's not enough time to send the letter, because by the time the letter gets to him, we might be all dead. So the hotline's a good idea. So it's Fidel Castro, nearly killed us all. Fidel Castro retires in 2008, placing his brother Raul as head of Cuba. He then died on the 25th of November, 2016 in Havana at age 90. The legacy of Fidel Castro is a difficult one to summarize. Despite the widespread poverty and executions and mass exodus of Cubans, he's still revered in leftist circles. I think that this is due to the underdog status with their battle against the Goliath of America. It's hard not to root for them. But also Cuba is probably the least terrible of all the communist regimes.
It certainly presents to the outside world a much more relaxed and enjoyable lifestyle. That might be the beaches, that might be the music. I think that reflects in our impression of the place.
The left needs someone to revere, and these guys are probably the least worst. Upon Castro's death, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau wrote a very shocking statement, and he writes, "It's with deep sorrow that I learned today of the death of Cuba's longest serving president." Justin, it's called a dictator. Cuba's longest. It's easy to be president when you don't have elections. That sort of stuff is just very silly from Justin Trudeau. But maybe, you know, he's probably wearing blackface at the time. He was probably confused. He loves a blackface, that bloke. He did it like 3 times.
It's, I know.
Unnecessary. I think Fidel will be remembered as the man that did whatever was necessary for himself and to stay in power.
Upon his death, Amnesty International praised his work in healthcare and education. And one of the other things that I find interesting about Castro is that back in the mid-1990s, he was talking about the environment. He was raising the issue of what we then called global warming. So there were certainly elements of his rule for which he deserves credit. Also, unlike so many dictators, Castro went to great lengths to minimise any cult of personality around him.
Fidel creates a cult of personality out of Che after his death. He's the ideal man that we should all look towards and we should all be like Che. And he's also dead. He's not going to be a competitor to Fidel Castro.
One of the things we set out at the beginning was to look at the transitions of dictators. And it's been interesting along the way to compare those dictators that have a peaceful transition. And the fact that Castro was able to hand over to his brother with a minimum of fuss is reflective of the hold that he had on Cuba. François Duvalier. Let's put him into perspective and start by looking at the country of Haiti itself. Haiti is on the island of Hispaniola, named by Columbus, the Spanish island. It was one of the first places he landed in 1492. Haiti is on the western half. The Dominican Republic is on the eastern half of the island of Hispaniola. Haiti itself is only 80 kilometres east of Cuba. That has made the Dominican Republic nervous over the years that if Cuba were to invade Haiti, with or without Soviet support, that would place the Dominican Republic at risk. Haiti was a Spanish colony and then a French colony, obtained independence in 1804, having been inspired by the French Revolution. In the early years of the 20th century, Haiti was deeply in debt, or a number of Haiti corporations and banks were deeply in debt to the United States. So the US, in fact, occupied Haiti during the First World War and stayed as an occupying power up until 1934. Current size of Haiti, 11 million population, of whom 95% are of African descent.
They're descended of the slaves that they were brought to the island, yeah.
So, François Duvalier, born in 1907, son of a schoolteacher, wanted to get an education and by 1934 had obtained his medical degree. No record of him being expelled from school, interestingly enough. He served with great distinction in rural Haiti as a doctor. And in 1943, for example, he took part in a US-sponsored campaign trying to eradicate tropical diseases in the country. In 1944, he studied for a little while at the University of Michigan. And by 1946, he was highly enough thought of to be appointed the Director General of the National Public Health Service. By 1949, Duvalier had become the Minister for Health and Labour, and he'd retained the nickname he liked using when he was working in the rural areas of Papa Doc. He kept that nickname even when he became more a politician than a doctor. Haiti had a coup in 1950, and Colonel Magliore became president. He was then subsequently directly elected. He had a falling out with Duvalier, but eventually Magliore's rule meant that he had to flee. He fled to Jamaica in 1956. In the next 18 months, there were 3 provisional presidents. The army just kept chopping and changing.
There were 22 presidents of Haiti over this period, and I think only one finished a term leading up to Duvalier becoming president.
The chopping and changing was the sort of thing we used to talk about in Italy.
Around, or Australia.
Yes, good point. Good point. So there was an election scheduled for September of 1957. Duvalier emerged from hiding, declared himself a candidate, ran on a very populist platform, a black nationalist platform, and he was very focused on what was best for the black people of Haiti. He ran quite openly on what he called an anti-mulatto platform, and the word mulatto means one white parent, one black parent.
Mixed
breed. But he very much took the mulatto elite as his point of attack because he believed they were taking opportunities away from the majority black African descent Haitians. So he was elected president in September of 1957.
This is his inauguration day. There was an attempted coup on his inauguration. So these people just love a coup, but he's decided he's going to outlast them. He's going to stay in power. He's not going to be like all the others that have fallen before him. So he becomes a lot more ruthless than the others were willing to be.
Yeah, he'd certainly learnt a lot from watching all the coups that had happened since he first got active in politics. Spent a little bit of time consolidating his rule, and then the massive turning point in the type of person that de Valier was to become. In May of 1959, he suffered a heart attack. He was 52 at the time. That heart attack could well have been linked to his long-term diabetes, and a number of the sources say that he also suffered neurological damage as a result of that heart attack. He was out of action for many months, and he appointed a temporary leader named Barbo. Barbo was the head of the organization called the Volunteers for National Security. When de Valier returned to health, he had a falling out with Barbo, put him in prison, and eventually he was executed. One example of the fact that de Valier may have started to suffer from mental health episodes is that he'd been told by one of his spies that Barbo had been able to turn himself into a black dog to try and avoid detection. So de Valier sent all his troops out killing every black dog they could find. This is just one example of the nature of the regime that de Valier was implementing in Haiti. I used the term Volunteers for National Security. In Haiti, they called them the Tonton Macoute. That was actually a voodoo term for monster or bogeyman. They were euphemistically called the Volunteers for National Security, but in reality, they became the secret police.
A portion of them were pulled out of the prisons. They were just murderers pulled out of the prisons because he wanted people scarier and more violent than the army because he distrusted the army.
He wanted the Haitians to believe that he had power over the voodoo.
You mentioned how he used voodoo to control the population. The country is split 40% a Protestant and then 60% Catholic. And then it's also said that the country is 100% voodoo. This is a very powerful force that Duvalier harnessed the superstition of the public. So he styled himself after a spirit of the voodoo belief system as Baron Samedi. That's why he wore that suit with the black tie and the black rimmed glasses and the hat. This Samedi character is the guardian of the cemetery. He's like a dark underworld figure within the voodoo religion. And he began to talk and walk like this spirit. He even says at one point, he says, "I am not a human, I am a spirit." So he uses this superstition to scare the population. He takes baths with the decapitated heads of his enemies. He allows that information to leak out, and the people of Haiti believe that he's extracting the information from the skulls of his victims. They fear even thinking a critical thought about Papa Dr. Valier. And he would do all sorts of insane things. At the airport terminal exit, he places the corpse of a man that attempted to overthrow him. It must be terrible for the tourism industry. You fly into Haiti and then your first thing you see is this rotting corpse to send the message of, don't try anything, this is what will happen to you.
He did develop a cult of personality, and he made good use of his presidential guard and of his secret police. There's records of some 30,000 murders as he consolidated power, and that's without mentioning the beatings, the intimidation, rape, corruption, torture, misappropriation of aid money. And in fact, in respect of torture, there are stories that talk about putting people in baths of sulfuric acid in torture chambers, which just happened to be next to the presidential palace, so that he could watch through peepholes if he so desired.
That's
pretty sickening.
That's very grisly. He actually reads Machiavelli, and one of the most famous pronouncements of Machiavelli's The Prince is that it's better to rule by fear than through love, and Papa Dr. Valier really takes that on board.
Yeah, very much so. Similar to Cuba, a lot of the educated class decided to emigrate and left them very short of doctors and teachers, emigrated in their hundreds of thousands to the US, to Canada, to France, where they spoke the language, and that made a massive change to the dynamics of the population in Haiti. 1964, he ticked one of the big boxes for a dictator.
Ooh, I like this.
He declared himself president for life. There was a referendum. The ballot papers were pre-marked.
Really? What do you read? That's mad.
He was the only candidate.
Oh, that's
and
so good.
He was probably a bit unlucky to only emerge with 99.9% of the vote.
In the election that followed his initial election, he got 1.3 million votes to zero. And then now in the referendum, he gets 99.9% of the vote. Must have dropped a couple of votes.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that rounding worked. But by this time, he already had a fair amount of form on the board. In 1959, he severed diplomatic relations with Cuba. De Valier had actually been a friend of Batista, and maybe he learned a bit about embezzlement from him, because when Batista fled Cuba, he's said to have taken some $300 million with him. And severing relations in Cuba helped make De Valier look anti-communist, because he had his eyes on US money. The upshot, though, of the outcome of the election, even though he said, and I quote, "I accept the people's will," end of quote, is that the US cut off diplomatic aid. Late in 1963, after the assassination of President Kennedy, De Valier claimed that he had put a curse, a voodoo curse, on Kennedy. So he wanted to take some credit for Kennedy's assassination as a sign of him having fallen out with the United States.
He says that the number 22 is his lucky number, and he uses that as proof that he was responsible for Kennedy's assassination. The 22nd is the date on which he is elected, and on a different month, the 22nd is the date he was inaugurated, and then Kennedy famously was shot on November 22nd.
A couple of things that I find help sum up De Valier's rule. In 1966, he was excommunicated by the Pope for harassing the bishops. He wanted to run the church himself, and the Pope took exception to that, so excommunicated him. The only foreign head of state to visit Haiti during De Valier's regime was from Ethiopia. That was Emperor Haile Selassie, the only one foreign head of state in 14 years.
Why does he do that, Haile Selassie?
I think they had some similar philosophies.
The black nationalist stuff?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe we'll cover Haile Selassie in a future episode.
Yeah.
All the while, throughout Haiti, there was some work to try and put infrastructure into the rural areas, roads and water, etc. But there was still malnutrition and famine throughout the country. He was still, though, supported by the black rural class because of his continuing painting of the mulatto elite as being the capitalist enemies, black African component of the population. Under Papa Doc's rule, he rewrote the Lord's Prayer. And it started, and I quote, "Our Doc, who art in the National Palace, hallowed be thy name."
That is insane.
It became the Haitian Lord's Prayer.
Far out.
All of this while the per capita income in Haiti was the lowest in the Western Hemisphere. You talked about the Cubans being lucky to earn a dollar a day. In 1971, at the end of Papa Doc de Valier's regime, Haiti had a population of 4.5 million and a per capita income of $75 a year.
Ooh.
Even the Latin American average was $400 a year, which is a bit closer to that $30 a month you spoke about before. And in 1971, Haiti was recorded as having illiteracy rates of 90%. Tuberculosis was rife. Malnutrition was still rife. In April of 1971, he died of heart disease. He had, prior to that, organised for the National Assembly to rubber stamp the choice of his successor. Just happened to be his son, Jean-Claude, aged 19, who became Baby Doc. The nicest thing I've read about Jean-Claude is that he was led a playboy lifestyle, and he remained the leader of Haiti until 1986, at which time he fled the country. Amazingly enough, subsequently was able to return in the early years of the 21st century. And one of the things that really helps understand the state of Haiti as a country is to compare it with the Dominican Republic. So they share the same island and a lot of the same Spanish heritage. In Haiti, life expectancy for a male is 62 years. In Dominican Republic, it's 70. For a female, 67 years. In the Dominican Republic, it's 73. The literacy rate in Haiti, fortunately, has increased since the lows of 1971. It's still a relatively low 60%, whereas the literacy rate in Dominican Republic is 94%.
So this one man has just managed to take the whole country down. Struggling.
They've never recovered from the De Valier regime, even though that regime ended 34 years ago. Part of looking at the legacy of Papa Doc, it's worth looking at the son. Jean-Claude was leader of Haiti from 1971 to 1986. He was ousted in 1986 and fled the country. Amazingly enough, managed to return in the early years of the 21st century. But in 1980, he had a wedding which was said to have cost some $3 million. Ironically, in light of his father's position, Jean-Claude married a member of the mulatto elite. In 1983, Pope John Paul II visited Haiti and openly called for change, which led to Jean-Claude being ousted in 1986. So as I look back at Papa Doc Duvalier, I've made a bit of a list, and this might help us whether we categorise him as the archetypal dictator. Came to power by legal means, tick. Set up a presidential guard and a secret police, tick. Widespread corruption, bribery, extortion, tick. Torture and executions, tick. Fake elections, tick. President for life, tick. Worthy beginnings, well, he was a hard-working rural doctor for many years, so I'll give him a tick for that. Widespread propaganda, tick. Anyone who rewrites the Lord's Prayer. New constitution, new flag. Did he leave the country worse off? Yes, another tick there. But I think the clincher in this list of dictatorial characteristics is that with his intention to build a new capital city, which sadly today is only ruins in the jungle, but the name of the new capital city was going to be Duvalierville.
Oh, that's so good.
That's excellent.
That's the textbook for dictatorship right there.
So is he wearing medals? I didn't see him wearing any medals. That's the only thing we're missing.
But he did want to model his appearance on one of the wizards. That might not be the right word. Wearing military regalia and medals wouldn't have been consistent with that, which is a shame. I will admit, Scott, the more I read about this man, it didn't take very long to form an opinion about him.
He's horrific. The extortion of the country are so upsetting. Him and his thugs force local business owners, local farmers, already poor people, to sign over their businesses to him. It becomes, is the term kleptocracy? Kleptocracy? Yes. It's like the mafia is running a country. And then he'd have the gall to drive around Port-au-Prince, which is the capital, and throw small bills out the window. So you'd have all these starving adults chasing the car, hoping to pick up some of this cash that he bestows upon them.
It's an appalling list of behaviours. And yeah, the country's still recovering. I know Castro's no angel, but I'll be honest, if we're looking for biggest, baddest, meanest, I can't see how Castro compares.
All right. So I think in terms of the category of biggest, baddest, meanest, Duvalier is dominant over Castro. He didn't cause near to the degree of devastation that Duvalier caused in Haiti. In terms of significance, I'm going to have to give that one to Castro. He nearly killed us all. Very, very close. If it was up to him, we'd all be dead. We were a whisker away from him being the most significant man who ever lived by ending life on planet Earth.
Yeah, in terms of how close in the early 60s that came to a nuclear war, which, as you say, would have been a very short one. Fortunately, for the remaining 46 years of Castro's rule, we didn't get close to it again. If we're looking for an archetypal dictator, yeah, I can't go past Duvalier. I think he ticks all the boxes.
I'm shocked, but you've convinced me. Really went into this thinking Castro, he's the more famous of the two. Even the impact on Haiti is greater than the impact that Castro had on Cuba. Castro did a lot that was bad, but I don't think we'll see a country that has been so systematically impoverished by a leader.
Bled the country dry. Yeah, I can't go past Duvalier.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to Cuba. There's a reason I haven't been to Haiti.
That corpse at the airport.
That corpse at the airport really sends the wrong message. Congratulations to Papa Doc Duvalier. You remain in the running to be crowned history's biggest dictator. Sorry to Fidel Castro, you just miss out.
Bit of a surprise there.
I think Duvalier rightly earns this victory.
So, Scott, who are we going to look at in our next episode?
Next week's very exciting. We're going to England. Our first English language group of dictators. We have Henry VIII up against Oliver Cromwell.
Ooh, looking forward to that.
I'm very excited. Uncle Ian, thank you for your excellent work.
Likewise.
See you then.
Looking forward to it.